Our next speaker, Seamus Creedon, is the current manager of the Solvency II Group, which represents all European actuarial associations. He's affiliated with KPMG Europe, having been a partner until 2003. Seamus is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries. He's also a member of the Irish Society, selected North American bodies, and is also vice chair of the International Actuarial Association's Enterprise and Financial Risk Committee. Please welcome Seamus Creedon.
Gur of Magad a Kahirlak, is Gomeni Dia or of Illa Ermajin, Ta An Ahus or in Vahansha is Sydney. Thank you, Martin, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I won't continue my native Irish because that would be to try your patience. But I can say it is a real pleasure to be here in Sydney, a city which is certainly more Irish than London, where I live, and almost as Irish as Dublin, which is where I was born. Even the weather here seems to be Irish, or so the concierge at my hotel told me. He told me this twice, once on Saturday when the sun was shining, and again yesterday when it was raining. And in fairness, he was probably right both times. My brief this morning is to talk about international influences, and particularly European influences, on the role of the actuary looking forward. It's not my intention to imply that European actuaries somehow are different, but it is true that developments in European regulation, principally Solvency II, are changing the role of actuaries and are raising the bar in terms of what will be required of the actuaries of the future. I like to think I'm reasonably qualified to discuss this subject for two reasons. I do, in a sense, walk both sides of the street. I am an actuary, but I'm also, in many of the contexts in which I work, a recipient of actuarial advice and output. And I think that adds to my perspective and my expectation. As an actuary, I've been involved with the Solvency II development for some 10 years now. I was one of the KPMG team which did the original work as long ago as 2001 for the European Commission. And it's been my privilege as project manager for Group Consultatif to lead the effort of some 50 or 60 volunteer actuaries in responding to, contributing to the development of a huge legislative project. But what keeps the wolf from the door in my particular case is my work as a non-executive director at a number of companies. They include both life and non-life companies, insurance, and reinsurance in both the UK and Ireland. And it's in that context that I'm acutely aware of the considerable effort which many of my board colleagues have to make to take on board what they're receiving from their actuaries. These are not stupid people. These are intelligent business people. But it can still be a considerable effort to convey actuarial concepts to them. And I think that's our problem rather than theirs. I could talk for the whole morning about Solvency II, but that would be even more painful for you, I'm sure, than it would be for me. But 10 years is a long time to have spent with this particular project. And I was involved in briefing a number of IAA committees on progress at meetings here in Sydney over the last several days. I summed up the position of Solvency II as being in a delicate state. It is delicately poised. You will have read in your Financial Times or financial newspapers of many criticisms of Solvency II appearing lately, principally from Germany. Nevertheless, I think it is still a very soundly, if ambitiously conceived, legislative programme. It has its roots in the Basel development of banking regulation, but Solvency II was always more holistic, and I'd agree very much with Desmond on the need for holistic regulation. Solvency II was always more holistic, a more coherent and integrated approach, covering not only the quantitative requirements with which we actuaries tend to be preoccupied, but also issues of governance, disclosure, group supervision, and so on. It is a major project. Many of the difficulties in the context of Solvency II come from the ambition of applying a coherent regime across the 30 countries of the European Union and European Economic Area. I've discussed the Solvency II development with visitors from Taiwan, Singapore, China, and we've always been able to agree that it's much easier to impose a coherent regime in a single country than it is to have 30 countries agree on something sensible. Inevitably, the taint of grubby compromise comes into the air. Nevertheless, I believe that despite the criticism from some countries and the somewhat overdone protests of some parts of the industry, I believe, but maybe I'm being an optimist, that Solvency II will happen on 1st of January 2013 as planned, even if there is still some tidying up and transition to be dealt with subsequent to then. So let's assume that will happen. And I'd invite you now to come with me to February 2016, just a little less than 5 years hence. Because what I'd like to do is to look at the position of a holder of the actuarial function under Solvency II once the regime has been implemented. The picture on the slide is my hometown, Dublin, which, despite its well-publicised difficulties with banking and real estate, continues to be very successful as a hub for insurance activities within the European Union, with several multinational household names basing themselves there. So by February 2016, Solvency II, and particularly Pillar 2, the governance aspects, will have been operative for 3 years. The most significant part of that from the point of view of our profession is Article 48 of the Solvency II Directive, which for the first time requires every single one of Europe's 5,000 insurers to have an actuarial function. As we speak, colleagues in EIOPA, a new word, the European Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority, born on 1st of January this year, colleagues in EIOPA are working on development of technical and other standards to be complied with by holders of the actuarial function. For the first time, every one of Europe's insurers will be required to have actuarial commentary on specifically technical provisions in the background to their calculation, and also an actuarial opinion on underwriting policy and on reinsurance. I'll come on to say a little more about what that's likely to involve. So remember, we're in February 2016, and let's imagine that I'm the holder of the actuarial function for the multinational group based in Dublin, and I'm preparing for interaction with my board over the next week or so on the issues which I'm required to comment on under Solvency II. In this context, I see my role as one of a facilitator. It is ultimately the responsibility of directors to decide what the provisions actually should be. And my role is to provide them with the tools and the context to allow them to do that to best effect. So in preparing for the next board meeting, I'm thinking about how can I provide the directors with information which will allow them to make optimal decisions. How can I brief them on the lessons we've learned from our experience of the last year? And how can I bring them up to date on developments in relation to our own risk and solvency assessment, developments in risk management, and developments in relation to our internal model? The primary responsibility of the actuarial function is to provide a report on technical provisions which allows the board to make a decision on setting those. And some of the issues which have to be addressed are listed here. Solvency II aspirationally requires that data be all of accurate, appropriate and complete. The actuarial profession has been at pains to point out that data is never complete, sometimes accurate, and sometimes appropriate. So in my report to the board, what I want to bring out is the judgments I've made about data in relation to each of those criteria. Because those of us who've worked on provisioning know that the issue here is sufficiency, whether the data is sufficiently accurate, complete, to allow one to develop reliable estimates of an appropriate range for provisions and to allow recommendations to be made to the board. I also want to explain the judgments I've had to make where I have had to work around gaps in the data and to brief the board on developments in our information systems, which I believe would allow us to be more effective in provisioning going forward. The Donald Rumsfeld was the philosopher who distinguished between known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. And at least my ambition in this context is to bring out from my board the known unknowns. In my experience, with a good board and a good actuary, it's possible to have very valuable discussions of issues which help arrive at a consensus view of provisioning. A good example in the context of the financial crisis, at some of the companies in which I was involved, was discussion of taking a view on bond spreads and to what extent spreads were attributable to real credit risk factors and credit risk uncertainty, and to what extent they were attributable to liquidity pressures in the system. And as an actuary, I would have my views, but other directors who would have an involvement in investment markets in different contexts would also have their views. And by working together, I think we came up with better consensus than each of us might have achieved separately. A second important element of Solvency II is the internal model. You're probably well aware that the philosophy of Solvency II is to encourage firms, particularly large firms, but also more generally specialised firms and so on, to encourage these to use an internal model to calculate their solvency capital requirement, the target capital requirement under the Solvency II framework. My role in relation to the internal model as actuary is I'm not the owner of the model. It is the risk management function, and I believe this is right, it is the risk management function which owns the internal model. So my role is almost as a supplier to the risk management customer in that I can provide advice on the actuarial dimensions of the model and review its workings from an actuarial scientific perspective. So the internal model used to calculate capital requirements should be consistent with the techniques which I'm using to calculate technical provisions, which are formally my responsibility in the first instance. It should also be consistent with the approach used to the own risk and solvency assessment. You can think of Solvency II as requiring almost three layers of model. The calculation of technical provisions is one kind of conceptual model. The exploration of ORSA, the kind of dynamic financial exploration, is another kind of model. And in between those is the internal model, which is used to calculate the formal capital requirement. Those three models are appropriately different, but they should be consistent. And I see that as part of my role. I'm also required to opine on the underwriting policy of my firm. This subject, I guess, is potentially as long as a piece of string, but what I see myself doing is looking at the adequacy of our pricing across the products and distribution channels, and maybe taking something like a red, amber, green perspective on margin adequacy. Inevitably, it's the case that there will be some products which are earning satisfactory margins. Unfortunately, it will also be the case that there are some products which are in a red status, definitely requiring some change to products or costings or so on to achieve profitability. And there will be some in between which will be amber status, maybe not requiring immediate action, but having the potential to become red at some point in the future. A particularly interesting prospective challenge in the European context is going to be underwriting in relation to gender mix. I spoke to had lunch with a colleague here on Friday who said there are now three sexes, male, female, and European. And it's certainly the case that managing the mix of business by gender is going to present challenges to underwriters and actuaries going forward. I agree with the stance taken by the Institute of Actuaries, Institute of Faculty of Actuaries, which was to recognise this as a development which had its roots in, call it social policy or social politics, and which presents a challenge to us, but it's not an insuperable challenge. It's one with which our industry can deal. I think in the context of underwriting policy, particularly, assessment of consistency of standards is a challenge. This is something I'm involved in sitting on a reinsurance board, where quite a lot of change is going on in terms of knowledge and development of medical techniques, and ensuring that we maintain a consistency of standard in the information we seek and the way we assess it in the light of enhanced knowledge is something the board wants to keep a steady perspective on. I'm also obliged to opine on the reinsurance arrangements of my firm, which includes looking at consistency with our risk appetite. The development of our risk appetite statement is something which the board looks at least once a year. And we may conclude that having regard to developments in the market, we want more of some risks, less of others. Classically, for example, balancing the appetite for mortality risk and longevity risk is something which many boards find themselves having to think about from time to time. As actuary, I'm also concerned with the diversity and security of our reinsurance arrangements. I usually want at least a solid second source in relation to any particular line of capacity. And as part of this, I want to be satisfied that reinsurance is being treated appropriately within the technical calculations, and particularly the calculations of capital requirements. And it's certainly the case that non-proportional reinsurance particularly is not easily catered for in the Solvency II standard formula, and companies using non-proportional reinsurance will often have to have undertaking specific parameters or a partial internal model. Finally, in my forthcoming interaction with the board, I want to offer my views on the subject of own risk and solvency assessment. This is a key part of the governance element of Solvency II, and I think it's one which the supervisors have soundly judged. A key principle is that it is something which should be owned by the board itself. It is ultimately for the board, as it is for the management of any business, to be satisfied that it has adequate resources to meet its plans for the business over a sensible planning horizon. The process typically is choreographed by the risk management function, and in my view, ORSA is a lot about reconciling top-down, risk appetite-driven perspectives with bottom-up from those who are closest to ownership and assessment of individual types of risk. It's a lot about reconciling those two perspectives. It is a forward-looking process. In some ways, ORSA is analogous to the dynamic assessment of capital adequacy, which has been a feature of the North American scene for some time. And it's very much integrated with the planning cycle. So in my forthcoming report to the board as head of the actuarial function, I will want to take on board the implications of the last year's results and provisions for ORSA. We've had good results, but could that be leading to softer rates going forward? And is there therefore an issue to be considered for the ORSA? I've talked about the what of Solvency II. Now I want to say a little bit about the how. I'm reminded of, I think it was Milton Berle, said at some point he felt like Zsa Zsa Gabor's sixth husband. He knew what to do, but the challenge was how to make it interesting. In terms of the expectations of the European Actuary of 2016, I want to say a little bit about some of the key issues. In preparing to present to the board and have discussions with the board, I come back to the challenge of communication and expressing the issues in language which the board can reasonably be expected to understand and get to grips with. In this context, I want to rehearse the discussion with colleagues in management, particularly with risk management colleagues, and I want to have a conversation with the chairman so that between us we have a view of which particular points we want to expose for discussion, particularly points of judgment, and what sort of outcomes we can hope to achieve. I'm a firm believer in positioning board communication interactively. The whole value of a board in my experience, or a good board in my experience, is the diversity of perspective they can bring to bear. And to do that, you really need to have a context, an arena for discussion of the issues. I do want to present my own views. We all know about the difficulties of finding two-handed economists or two-handed actuaries. So while I will say on the one hand this, on the one hand that, I will also say that on balance my view is we go in this direction, but I'm open to discussion. And I think that's the right approach to take to communication in this particular context. Perhaps the biggest single challenge, and this is a specific in the wording of the Solvency II legislation, the biggest single challenge is communication of genuine uncertainty. In my experience, scenarios can be very useful. Boards find it difficult to attach probabilities to a given scenario. But we have had some very good discussions about what I call the edge of plausibility, the scenario which is about as bad as you can imagine, but you can imagine it. And you can get very good discussions from boards by positioning it in that particular context. Use of scenarios, particularly having regard to history, but not falling into the trap of assuming that the future will look like the past, because inevitably it won't. It can be very useful. This is where membership of a profession is valuable, because we all know the saying, 10 actuaries, 11 opinions. The discussion with other actuaries can be a way of helping flesh out one's thinking on scenarios and possible scenarios that might be part of the discussion with board colleagues. Solvency II requires that the head of the actuarial function be operationally independent. Which is an interesting concept. I think in many ways independence is a state of mind, and one which one acquires gradually over a long period of time. I certainly learned to appreciate the value of independence some nearly 30 years ago when I was CEO of a small company. I, in a moment of foolishness, agreed to be actuary of the same company to keep expenses down. And I found that a very uncomfortable situation. And when I was headhunted shortly afterwards to set up a new life company for the Bank of Ireland, my first step was to hire a strong potential actuary, because I needed that independent challenge within the management team. I also think those of us who've had involvement with auditing and the audit firms, that's very good in terms of developing what I call professional scepticism and independence of mind, which certainly has stood to me subsequently. I'm not sure whether there are shortcuts to achieving an independent perspective. I do think one valuable factor is that there's almost always a commonality of interest between an actuary thinking independently and the non-executive directors on the board. Because as a non-executive director, I value seeing an independent perspective coming from the actuary inside the organisation, which is not automatically the same as the CEO's. I'm a strong believer that the best actuaries are good team players. I've been fortunate throughout my career to work with good people from a range of contexts. I still remember the first time I moved from being responsible mainly for actuaries to being responsible for a whole organisation, including salespeople and so on. It was something of a road to Damascus experience, but it was probably more valuable to me than to my poor sales director who had me as his boss. But one learns over the years to appreciate quality in a whole variety of contexts, and to appreciate the satisfaction, the richness of working in a strong and balanced team. Now, when looking at hiring actuaries, hiring people, I try to look for evidence of a restless curiosity and a capacity to work out of the box, to work well with people who are not actuaries. There's a saying which that actuaries are great communicators, but only with each other. But again, I'm an optimist. I don't believe that has to be true. So I've painted a picture of the tangible challenges of Solvency II and some of the less tangible background to meeting those. As a nearing conclusion, I've tried to think about what it's going to take for actuaries to be successful, to be winners in the environment of 2016. And I think the key attribute is one of balance, a balance of technical ability and professionalism. And if we think about it, if we think about the kind of, say, the doctors we've had that we've most admired or the lawyers we've found best to work with, they usually have displayed that balance of being solid technically, but also displaying a concern for our interests and a concern to understand what we were trying to achieve from consultation with them. And it's that balance which I think is important for us actuaries to try to achieve. My impression, and it's an impression mostly from a great distance, is that the profession here in Australia is in relatively good shape in those terms. We sometimes talk in the UK about the great many of our excellent actuaries have a principally mathematical background. I have a sense of greater balance in the profession here, and indeed in the profession in Ireland. I think in terms of the content and the content to acquire, I'd probably be echoing Desmond that understanding what makes the difference between good and poor governance is a key issue. Again, I think this is an issue, and I worked with Ian Loughlin and others on the development of the curriculum for the ST9, the risk management subject, which I think we're now both examining in. And Ian placed great stress on that understanding of governance and organisation behaviour. And I think he was absolutely right. Again, it's a lesson of the crisis that it was governance deficiencies which usually made the difference when things went wrong. So there are directions for personal and professional development which I think Solvency II will draw us into. And it does strike me that the profession here in Australia is well placed to achieve those. And hopefully I've stimulated some questions which we can discuss as we go. Gaurav Míle Maithreoir, and thank you very much for bringing me here to Sydney.
Thank you, Seamus. We will take up your invitation for questions a little later.